From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll share the Milwaukee Police Department's pursuit policy and how it's being enforced and monitored. Then we'll tell you about an upcoming lecture about Black history that is often never taught.
First of all, we were taught nothing. And when I was in school, I learned about Martin Luther King, I learned about Rosa Parks, and I learned about Frederick Douglass. That was it.
Plus, we'll look at a documentary that explores the history of Jones Island.
There are few landscapes in Milwaukee or anywhere, you know, that have been through so many transformations. It shows you how easy it is for us to transform the landscape and how easy it is to forget what was there before.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. In 2024, Milwaukee's police department pursued more vehicles through city streets than ever before. That's according to the Fire and Police Commission. Police pursuits can be dangerous for officers and the community, which is why the police department has continued to change their pursuit policy over time. Tragically, in the past few months, a number of bystanders have been killed as a result of police pursuits. Leon Todd from the city's Fire and Police Commission joins WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez to explain MPD's pursuit policy and if it's worth it.
Can we get your breakdown on what's in SOP 660? What does it say about local police, their ability to engage in vehicle pursuits, and when?
Well, it says a lot. I'll try to break it down as simply as I can and hit the highlights. It lists the specific reasons or the specific types of cases in which officers are allowed to go on a vehicle pursuit. And I want to emphasize that it's not saying that officers must pursue vehicles in these situations, but these are the situations when they are allowed to do that. They still retain their discretion within those reasons to enter into a pursuit. So, for example, if the occupant has committed, is committing, or about to commit a violent felony, such as an armed robbery, recklessly endangering safety, something of that nature, an officer would be justified or permitted to initiate a pursuit. Another example is when a vehicle is used or taken during the attempt or commission of a violent felony. Another one is if a vehicle or occupant presents a clear and immediate threat to the safety of others. The final two reasons are if there is drug dealing approximately in time to the initiation of the pursuit. I'll stress, however, that ground is limited to situations or incidents where it is a substantive drug investigation or a long-term investigation.
So this wouldn't be in the case of someone just like maybe seeing something that they perceive to be a drug deal interaction.
That's correct. It would have to be a substantive investigation or a long-term investigation. And then finally, the final ground is if the necessity of immediate apprehension outweighs the level of danger created by the vehicle pursuit. Again, I want to stress that those are the situations when officers are allowed to initiate pursuits. They're not required to. And even when they do initiate a pursuit for one of those reasons, they have to continually monitor the situation and determine whether or not it is justified and appropriate to continue the pursuit. And they always have to exercise due regard and take that into account for the safety of the public and others.
Lots of discretion. Also, it seems like quite a bit of reasons to potentially pursue vehicles. Has that policy changed over time? I'm looking back at the stats here, and it looks like there's this huge jump in pursuits around 2017.
Yes. So in 2017, the FPC did direct the police department update the policy, and that was in response to a large number of pursuit situations or fleeing situations. Those had steadily increased over time. It was determined that the pursuit policy should be expanded to give officers more ability and more tools or more situations where they can engage in vehicle pursuits. And it was decided that the policy would be amended to include situations that involve drug dealing, again, in proximate time to the initiation of the pursuit, as well as situations involving reckless driving.
you and the Fire and Police Commission have been publishing yearly reports about data behind vehicle pursuits, and your last big report came out in 2023. Were there big findings? What did you learn there?
Well, I think, like you showed, it does indicate that there was a substantial increase in the number of pursuits in 2017. It went up to 900, I think, either in 2018, after the policy was changed. But I would also note that the number of non-pursuits also has gone down dramatically. So I think the policy has worked as designed. I think that under the old policy, it had become, unfortunately, somewhat common knowledge that police would not pursue in certain situations, and various people would take advantage of that. That was the aim of the policy, to allow police to pursue individuals so that they couldn't flee with impunity.
So the data is saying that we have both more pursuits than ever before and also more fleeing from vehicles as well. Is the pursuit policy as is having the desired results? Are we seeing a drop in reckless driving and other crimes?
That's a complicated question. I think there's a lot of things that go into reckless driving. It's not just enforcement. It's things like education, design, traffic calming measures. Those are the three components that really need to be pressed in combination in order to combat reckless driving. I think on the enforcement side of things, it is important that officers be able to pursue when appropriate and when safe to do so. But that has to obviously be balanced with the need to ensure public safety. Obviously, vehicle pursuits can be dangerous. They can result in accidents and injury. So we want pursuits when appropriate, when we're talking about situations involving violent felonies, other situations that present a clear danger to the public, which outweighs the potential danger that would be created by a pursuit. The other thing I would note is, from the FPC's perspective, as you noted, we've done the vehicle pursuit annually, with some exceptions, annually for some time now. That report really looks at the data and gives a bird's eye view of the data and trends and things of that nature. In 2024, we did something new. We wanted to take a little bit of a deeper look at how the practice is working on the ground. So we did a vehicle pursuit audit. So our auditors at the FPC took a random sample of vehicle pursuits. They reviewed the police reports, the body cam and squad cam videos for that, to assess whether or not MPD in practice was complying with their policy. We saw that in over 98% of cases that were reviewed, the initiation of the vehicle pursuit was justified under SOP 660. In over 90% of the cases, MPD officers terminated pursuit as required by the SOP. There's a number of other findings in there as well, but our auditors did substantively review that random sample of vehicle pursuits, made several recommendations, both for individual cases, and then on a more policy-wide basis. So one of the significant recommendations that we made is that MPD should create a vehicle pursuit committee similar to the use of force committee that they already have, which meets quarterly. And our recommendation is that the committee should meet regularly and review vehicle pursuits to identify potential issues at an early stage. The committee can help identify members for the early intervention program, policy reminders, remedial training, and training examples that they can use at in-service and other trainings. And my understanding is that MPD is receptive to those recommendations and are already working on implementing them.
You know, in 2017, it sounds like FPC had quite a bit to say in recommending what happens to the pursuit policy. And I know things have changed with the FPC and Act 12 and some of these foundational changes to the commission. What kind of power does the Fire and Police Commission have to shape this policy?
You know, quite a bit, I think. Obviously, we don't have, or the commission does not have the direct power anymore to approve or change standard operating procedures. But like I just shared, We can do audits. We can do reviews of policy, make recommendations, both through audits and policy recommendations. And ultimately, it is the commission that hires the chief, that reviews his performance, the department's performance and operational effectiveness. And the department does take our recommendations seriously. So there may not be that direct power, but there is soft power, so to speak. And there is a very good relationship both with the FPC board and the FPC staff on the one hand, and then the Milwaukee Police Department. So we work collaboratively, and ultimately we all want the same thing. We want public safety. We want effective, professional, and legal and safe law enforcement in the city of Milwaukee.
Vehicle pursuits, police chases have been called some of the most dangerous things that police do. Recently, there have been some heartbreaking bystander deaths as a result of these pursuits. I'm thinking of the 60-year-old grandfather, Clarence Bibbins, who was fatally hit by a car fleeing a police pursuit. His daughter had spoken up and called for an end to MPD's police policy. There's also Beverly Fair, the 70-year-old grandmother of 12. She was struck while traveling in her grandson's SUV. MPD didn't call this a pursuit by their definition, but the vehicle was being pursued by MPD. Thinking of how MPD weighs the lives of residents to its SOPs, is it worth it?
You know, I think that's a very good question. It is a balancing act that has to take place. There has to be the ability for law enforcement to enforce the law, pursue individuals when appropriate. And I think the people of Milwaukee also expect and demand the police department to enforce the law, to pursue people to the best of their ability when reasonable and appropriate. That ensures public safety. At the same time, that is balanced against the need not to create or amplify a dangerous situation to an unacceptable degree. I think the standard operating procedure right now does a good job of balancing all those things. So I believe that it is a difficult situation that has to be balanced. And I believe that the policy we have in place now, it does that very appropriately and to the best that can reasonably be expected.
Leon Todd is with the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. He spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. While police pursuits were up last year, there is some evidence the city's efforts to reduce reckless driving are working. You may have noticed things like big concrete bump outs along corners or protected bike lanes. These projects are put in place to try to get drivers to slow down and to protect bikers and pedestrians. Jeremy Janine of Urban Milwaukee wrote all about Milwaukee's traffic calming efforts early last year, looking at successes and growing pains. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more.
When was it exactly that the city started to implement and build these traffic calming measures?
I think if you wanted to look for a date, the fall 2018, the city approved this complete streets plan. And it was this idea that we should design our streets for all users, not just drivers. It should be bus riders, bikers, pedestrians, people of all abilities, too. So not Lance Armstrong, but also my daughter who's out there on a bike and your grandma crossing the street to get to the grocery store. That the design should protect and encourage all people to use our streets in all ways.
So can you explain like what these projects are and what their goal is, what they look like? You mentioned bike lanes are one aspect of it. What other visual cues are people noticing?
Yeah, the key thing with all traffic calming and thinking about complete streets is speed. We know that your injury risk grows and your death risk grows exponentially as speed increases. So if you can reduce someone's speed from 40 to 35 miles per hour, you can do a lot to save their life in the case of an accident or a collision, which are going to happen. So the idea is let's do things to the street to encourage people to go a little bit slower. One of the major things people are seeing in Milwaukee is these concrete bump outs, which is this little island in the parking lane. And if you think about the open road in a TV commercial encourages you to go fast. Well, you go slow when there's kind of stuff next to you. When you're on the freeway and that barrier is right next to you, you're slowing down. So kind of putting those in to encourage you to slow down. There's also the idea of moving, swapping the bike lane and the parking lane so that the biking is protected by the parked cars. There's this barrier there. It, again, narrows the driving field of vision, but also creates a physical barrier for bikers.
So one common thing in these calming efforts is they are along some of the busiest streets, whether data of speeding or accidents support that. That's where we're seeing these efforts start first. So about how many traffic calming projects are on Milwaukee streets right now?
There are dozens and dozens of changes happening. Some are small, like, okay, in front of this school near Humboldt Park, we're just going to put this raised crosswalk in. But near the Midtown Center Shopping Center, we're going to do $1 million of improvements on Capitol Drive.
Gotcha. So speaking of Humboldt Park, some of these projects along busier roadways have a two-phase road diet as well, with extra measures added, like here's the initial step of, say, the bike lanes and other things, and the next step is the concrete bump outs you talked about. So can you explain kind of the phases that Humboldt Park, the roadways along there, had, for example?
Sure. One thing to understand about Milwaukee is Milwaukee went through this great effort to widen its streets, and then it built a freeway system. So we have a lot of streets that are admittedly too wide by any standard, Oklahoma Avenue being one of those. The idea was simply use paint in 2020 to narrow the street, take four lanes in each direction, make it one lane in each direction with a center turn lane. There was some data that worked a little bit, but then the concrete came later funded by a federal project.
And initial data is showing that these projects are working, right?
Yeah, the tremendous results have been seen both on Oklahoma Avenue and Lapham Boulevard near historic Mitchell Street. If your goal is to save lives, they show that the data is likely to do that in any collision.
So let's talk about the one along Mitchell Street neighborhood. This section of traffic calming was a bit controversial. Why was that?
Yeah, it was rolled out near South Division High School and another elementary school. And the city just rolled it out, and there was a lot of confusion on, hey, where do I park now? This is an example of a project where the bike lane and the parking lane were swapped. So it's a bit unnatural, especially if you're the first person on the block to park, because usually the concrete curb has been this cue. I park right up next to that. I want to get as close as I can. Well, now all of a sudden you got to look for the plastic bollards, the kind of the dividers, to park away from the curb so that the bikers can go on the passenger side of the car instead of the driver's side of the car. When you think about pickup drop-off near schools, that was a huge communication issue and a hurdle. And so the city quickly looked at the data, 69% reduction in speeding in that area. The median speed went down by 5 miles per hour to actually below the speed limit. So an incredible safety improvement, but the city openly admits that it needs to do a better job communicating how you use it.
So with this data, let's talk about how it's actually collected. How are they measuring, like, this significant speed reduction?
It's a fairly, for me as an outsider, I can say it's a fairly simple machine. I'm sure an engineer would disagree. But it's a little tube that's placed on the road, and you just leave it there in a targeted window. And there's very key strategic decisions you need to do there. You need to get the data before you make any changes. You need to get the data after, obviously. But you need to make sure you're studying it in the same window. I think the city said they like to do a Tuesday through Thursday, kind of 48-hour, 72-hour review. And they now have that data in select cases and are trying to build more of it to understand, hey, is this working, or we need to go further, or, we went too far.
Yeah, so for the two-phase projects, for example, is that, you know, seeing like, hey, this data is okay, but it could be better?
Yeah, we didn't get great data from the city on what happened just after they did paint on Oklahoma Avenue, but they did get great before data, so you can really see near Humboldt Park, lots of pedestrians crossing into the park, that speeds went way down when both phases were implemented.
As you mentioned, you spoke with the city, specifically city engineer Kevin Muse, and he says that the main focus and outcome of these projects is, of course, reducing speed. You mentioned speed is a big factor of someone's physical outcome should an accident happen. Obviously, we don't want them to, but what other key parts of this effort helps reduce speed?
Yeah, so the big thing is designing streets in a way that encourages you to go a little bit slower. They don't mean stopping all the time, but just when you're driving, I don't want you going 15 miles per hour over. I want you driving the speed limit. It's kind of the goal of the traffic engineer now. And so looking at ways that can kind of make you feel, I guess, cozy, for lack of a better term, not this wide open road, but hey, I'm driving down this nice narrow street. I can still be flowing through green lights if I'm going the right speed. But that I'm being cautious, and that gives the driver more opportunity to see people that are coming. And if, yes, if there is that collision, that it's not a terrible outcome for everyone.
Bottom line, like, make us focus more.
Yes.
When we're on the road. Yeah. You mentioned one growing pain for South Division High School. What other kind of growing pains did they learn from that is going to hopefully help them implement new projects better down the road or just change the way they go about it?
Well, simply maintaining this infrastructure is going to be a challenge. And when we look at the concrete bump outs, there's a little gap designed between the curb and the bump out. So, like, why not just connect this? Well, they weren't connected so that drainage could occur. But you also got to consider our snow plows hitting this stuff. One of the learning curves for the city, Kevin Muse has admitted this in public meetings, is there's still reckless drivers out there that are hitting these poles that are on these concrete bump outs, and the city is spending more to replace those poles than it thought.
So is there a point in which, you know, the city would say it's gone too far? I mean, it's an adjustment for drivers regardless, but I imagine feedback is mixed and some people really don't like it. Others are fine with it. But, you know, it's definitely a change of your pace, of your driving, of people's commutes.
Well, the city has explicitly endorsed a goal of Vision Zero, an international campaign to have zero traffic deaths. Unfortunately, Wisconsin had a record number in 2022 that came down 18%. In 2023, but what seems like a big drop is still a very elevated number, and Milwaukee County as a whole still leads the way. And Vision Zero is not just pedestrian deaths, it's people dying in collisions. Speed is an issue not just for a car hitting a pedestrian, but a car hitting another car. So any way that you can improve safety, I think there's a thing that needs to be understood about reckless driving is it's not just someone stealing a Kia and driving at insane speeds. It's the mother that's speeding to get their kid to class. It's the journalist like me that's rushing to get to a meeting that's going just a little bit too fast. We're all guilty of reckless driving at some point, and we all could use visual cues and street design that encourages us to drive slow.
So there's these plans that they implement, but what's the process like for public feedback? Have they gotten a lot from residents?
Well, certainly with the Lapham Boulevard project, there's plenty of feedback. I mean, one of the key things to understand about public works is we talk about this effort started in 2018. Well, some of the projects that were on the drawing board then are now finally getting to construction. National Avenue is due to be reconstructed in a couple of years. That these projects take years and often involves several public meetings about the potential street redesigns.
So given that longer timeline and the things that need to happen in order to plan and execute these, how many more projects are in the works for Milwaukee?
There's 45. I would expect that rate to continue for the next couple of years. One of the key things the city did with its influx of pandemic aid through the American Rescue Plan Act was spend it on traffic calming improvements. That money is going to run out by the end of 2026. The city has found other sources, tax incremental financing districts, which are, if you think about what projects those might be, like the new Northwestern Mutual Tower downtown, the increased property tax revenue from that could pay for street improvements nearby, but you only have so many of those projects. The city also gets state and federal aid to rebuild roads. You only get so many of those projects. So this pandemic aid allowed a surge in funding, but that's going to unfortunately slow down in the next couple of years.
So with the limitations of funding and how much you get year to year, do you think it's still going to try and be as much of a priority for the city as they can make it?
I think so. I think just that key thing with public works is understanding that you're not going to rebuild every single road every single year. It's going to take a long time to rebuild Milwaukee's network of streets.
Well, and as this continues, we'll get more data, and I'm sure you'll help us understand what's working and what's not working. So, Jeremy, thanks for coming in and sharing more.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Janine is the president and co-founder of Urban Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last year. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Do you know about Milwaukee's Jones Island? It's not just a stinky thing you drive over on the Hone Bridge. We'll tell you about the history of Jones Island in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll look at how Black history has been taught and learn about a lecture that's highlighting stories often left out of school curriculum. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers, a lecture intended to tell the stories of Black people's contributions to America that often get left out of history books, is back for its second year at Marquette. It's called Things Your History Teacher Didn't Teach You, Blacks in History, Part 2. Derek Mosley is behind it. He's the director of the law school's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. Mosley has been posting stories about Black people's presence in American history for more than a decade on social media. WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell spoke with Mosley about the upcoming lecture.
So my mom, her siblings all went to high school in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so when I was growing up, my mom had told me about the Tulsa race massacre. And I remember I was like in fifth grade and my mom said, "Hey, are you learning about the Tulsa race massacre?" So I went and asked the teacher, said, "Hey, are we going to learn about Tulsa and the race massacre?" And my teacher said, "It never happened." So I remember going home and talking to my mom. "Hey, the teacher said it never happened." And she blew up. And so the next day at school, she's dragged me. Where is she? Point her out. Is that her right there? And then she had this conversation with the teacher. And from that moment on, she made it her mission to make sure I knew everything. And I have made it my mission to make sure my children know everything. And now with social media, it's given me the ability to have it go out all over the place. I had one story about the 6888s. I did maybe 3 years ago before anybody knew who they were. And that story has like been shared 140,000 times. And so social media is allowing me to reach people with these stories that I never would have reached just doing a lecture series, you know, here and there. And, you know, I have so many stories because once you start on this journey, you realize that, first of all, we were taught nothing. And when I was in school, I learned about Martin Luther King. I learned about Rosa Parks and I learned about Frederick Douglass. That was it. Didn't learn about Malcolm X because he was a little too radical. And it wasn't until I started reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and listening to his speeches that I realized he really wasn't that radical. But it had been drained into us that he was too radical. So even when the stories were always out there, but they were a lot easier to hide when you had to try to find them in libraries of the Dewey Decimal System, right? But now a Google search could take you anywhere. And now the archives, the U.S. archives are open to the public. So you could do that as well. And so there's so many rich stories and they're important to tell.
What does your research look like?
Yeah, so it's myself and my sister together. We do the same thing. She also does, she's still DEC in Chicago, and she does her same thing I do, 28 facts. And so we interchange stories. We do our own independent research and then we exchange stories so that we can cover the gamut of Black culture. Right. And so it starts with Google searches. It starts with buying books. I was just down in Chicago at the Newberry Library trying to buy books on Black history. That's where I get a lot of my information from. The books are there. Fortunately for us, we have some amazing Black historians who have put all these into books that we can access either virtually or buy them, you know, at the library. And so it's made it a lot easier than it was when I first started. When I first started, it was literally going to the library and say, "Where's your Black history section?" "Well, we don't have a Black history section." "All right, well, give me a book about anybody Black, and then I'll go from there."
How do you choose what you're going to talk about?
Yeah, so there's no chronological order to it, really. Okay. I just take all these stories that I've amassed over a decade, and I just decide these are the 28 I'm going to feature today, and those are the 28 I'm going to feature next year. This never stops. I mean, from last year, when February, it was actually a leap year, so it was like, what, February 29th last year. From that moment till this moment, I've been researching new stories. And stories tend to like, it's sort of like a river. It has all these little tributaries and they go in all different directions. History is intertwined. It connects, and because all of us are connected. And my favorite quote is by James Baldwin. And he said, "The past is not the past. It's the present in everything that we do today," which is so true. things that happened in the past is the reason why things are the way they are now. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't learn that, we will continue to make those same foolish mistakes.
You know, I know you talked about your mom really making it a priority to make sure you knew history, and now you do that for your children. Did you foresee yourself kind of taking on this mantle of sharing history with the community in this way?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, when I first started doing it, I just thought I was going to throw it on Facebook, and it was just something I throw out that my Facebook friends would see, right? And that was it. But then one friend saw it and shared it. Then another friend saw it and shared it. And then it just started to multiply to the point where I had reached my limit of Facebook friends, like within like the first, you only allowed 5,000 on Facebook, and that was gone like in a year, because wow, people were like, I want to follow you. I've taken friend requests from people, and then, and then that got full, and now people were following. And I love it because people want to hear these stories. And now Instagram opened up a new realm too. You're hitting a younger generation, you know, because the Facebook group is mostly like older generation of people, but yeah, they didn't learn it either. And so a lot of them are like, what? I never knew that story. That's hard to believe. And the one that like surprises like a lot of people is anything like around World War II. Because when you watch movies of World War II, when you were growing up, there were never any Black people in it. And so I went like the most of my life, young life, watching these movies thinking, oh, Black people didn't do anything in World War II, right? Mm. We didn't tell those stories. A classic example is everybody knows Rosie the Riveter, right? Mm. You've seen the picture, We Can Do It. And every time you see it, it's always a white woman. And then when you saw the pictures of her of Life magazine, of these Rosies, they were all white women. But there were over 400,000 Black Rosies, 400,000 that we have sort of like kind of like erased from history. And finally, now we're starting to understand all those stories that all of us have contributed to what this country is all about.
People probably have an idea of the consequence of not hearing these stories, but I want to hear what your perspective is when you don't tell all these stories of Black people's presence, for example, in World War II. What are the consequences of leaving those stories, those people, those perspectives out of history?
Yeah, other than the fact that that you miss like the total comprehensive lecture of history of the United States. Besides that, it helps you understand why some things are the way they are, right? Mm-hmm. So when you drive in a car and you go to the suburbs, and while you're in the suburbs and you look around and you see, why is the suburbs 95% white? Why is that? But if we tell the stories that the vast majority of people who made it into the middle class, especially men, was because of the GI Bill. So they served their country, and then they got the GI Bill. They got low interest loans. They got free college. They got free loans for houses, free farms to try to farm to make them, you know, this is our thank you from the country. But what we don't tell is that 1 million Black soldiers were denied the GI Bill, right? So this vehicle, which took whites into the middle class, was completely taken away from Blacks who served in that same war, right? Put their lives on the line. And so when you think of that and say, well, if the GI Bill took my grandfather and got him to the middle class where he got this house, and this house was then passed on to my parents, and then you have this generational wealth that keeps going, and then you look on another side of town, and you're like, well, everybody here rents. Why are they all renting? And why? I don't understand how this is happening. Well, when we tell those stories, and I'm not even getting to redlining, when we actually just said, you know, we're not going to build houses in these neighborhoods, right? I'm not even getting to that. I'm talking about even before that, this vehicle. One thing that brought the country together was this world war. We're going to fight evil. We're going to do democracy. And everybody stepped up to do it. Men, women, all different races and cultures. And then the war is over, but we're not going to give our thank yous to these 1 million Black men and women who served valiantly, right? Hmm. Served valiantly. We're not going to tell their stories. And so that helps you get a better perspective of why some things are the way they are, or why some groups haven't succeeded as well as other groups. Hmm. And so That's why we tell these stories. When we don't tell these stories, then people think that the history they learn is the full comprehensive history of America. And then they say things like, well, why do we have a Black History Month? We don't have a White History Month. Right? You only hear that when you don't know the story, right?
Right.
The educated person who knows that story would never, ever say that. And then not to mention the fact, Taryn, that history helps us to not repeat the past. When we know our history, we know the mistakes we made in the past, and we don't repeat them. And so when you hear stories of how people's constitutional rights were trampled or their human rights were trampled, we don't want to duplicate that. But if we don't tell that story, we never heard that it ever happened, then everything seems like it's happening for the first time, when in fact, we've gone down this road before.
Absolutely. That necessary context is missing.
Yes.
So tell me what you think about this. We're witnessing folks in power attempt to erase Black history, really any marginalized group's history, but particularly under this current administration. Do you think there will be more spaces popping up where Black people will be taking control of passing down that history in the community and in neighborhoods because the schools won't?
It's happening now. Mm-hmm. You could go on TikTok, you can go on Instagram, you can go on any form of social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, and there are people just like me and my sister who are telling these stories every single day, not just during Black History Month, every single day. And it's become the mission of all of us who are doing this work to get these stories out. And our reach is farther than we ever thought it could ever be. I mean, I get messages from people in other countries who were like, wow, I had no idea that was that story. That person who was in Slovenia would never know me at all if it wasn't for that story. And so we're bringing everything closer together. So they can say, you know, I'm not going to teach this. We're going to ban those books, and we're not going to do this or that. But the message is already getting out. Mm-hmm. And it's getting out to younger and younger generations. I mean, there's a whole bunch of young people on TikTok who are able to tell these Black history stories within like 18 seconds. They'll tell you the whole story of somebody in 18 seconds. And it's amazing. And it's easy. You hear it. And then from there, you move on to the next. You're like, oh, well, let me find out more about this story. Remember, I'm not here to tell you the entire diaspora of Black history.
Right.
I'm here just to tell you little stories that you might say to yourself, I'd like to learn a little bit more about this person. And then you do research on it. And then you find something new. And then you share that information. And then it just keeps flowering and flowering. We live in a society now where it's going to be really hard to keep those stories hidden because we are so connected to the rest of the world.
Derek Mosley is the director of the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School. He spoke with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about his lecture, Things Your History Teacher Didn't Teach You, Blacks in History, Part 2. The event is happening Wednesday at Marquette University. When we come back, we'll explore the history of Milwaukee's Jones Island. That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's Jones Island has a long history that many people may not realize when passing over it on the Hone Bridge. It was home to the largest Native American village in Milwaukee, served as a trading post, shipyard, fishing village, and now is strictly industrial. The history of the peninsula was the subject of a PBS documentary called People of the Port. John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian who worked on the documentary, along with Claudia Luz, who is the director, co-producer, and editor. They joined me in 2022 to share more about Jones Island and the documentary.
Many Milwaukeeans pass by or often over Jones Island every day, maybe without realizing it. What are some of the earmarks of modern-day Jones Island that people might be familiar with?
Both sight and smell. It is the home of Milwaukee Sewage Treatment Plant. So you get that when you're crossing the home bridge. It's also where all our road salt comes in. So you have these salt mountains, as well as what they call tank farms, petroleum products, freight yards. Nobody lives there. But it's a very non-residential landscape. And the home bridge, that's how you get across.
Of course, that wasn't always the case. At times in its history, as your documentary gets into, there was a flourishing village that really stood out in the landscape of urban cities around the nation. But before that, before settlers even come to Milwaukee, how much do we know about its native history, Jones Island?
We know that it was the site of the largest Indian village in Milwaukee, and the first identifiable record of Milwaukee is 1679, when a priest named Zenobius Membre, what a great name, recorded a village at the river mouth. So it's been a site of human habitation for a very long time, but probably 500 people up to 1,000 people. As in native times, right at the tip of the peninsula.
Now, I had assumed that the industrialization of Jones Island was a newer phenomenon, something that maybe happened during the 1900s. But in many ways, that's a core part of its history once settlers arrive in the area. I guess I wondered as I was watching the documentary, why is that? Is it because of the location? Did the location just say to people like, you gotta make stuff there?
They actually didn't make much there, Joy. It was more processing. You know, it was the sewage plant. It was infrastructure and is infrastructure. And that was so obvious. It was the right place for both the port, because it's Milwaukee's front door, as well as all that intramodal transportation or intermodal transportation between rail and boat and roads as well. So it's Milwaukee's front door. It's Milwaukee's front door. So that made it the obvious place for all the things that are there now.
It starts its history, it seems, when settlers get there, as they built ships there. Is that?
Yes, there was shipbuilding on Jones Island back in, John, what was the year?
1853.
Yes. And that's actually the reason it's called Jones Island. It was Captain Jones who was the schooner builder. And they could build a schooner in 60 days. And they were doing that on the island just with an enormous amount of noise, I suspect, and lots of people. And they pumped out these schooners, and they are absolute beauties. I mean, we have photographs in the documentary of examples of schooners from that time.
The documentary itself is really image rich. There are a lot of different images. I was particularly struck by kind of the next era of Jones Island and the images that we get from the fishing village that was on Jones Island that I think lives in a special place in Milwaukee history. I was curious, where did you even find all of these images of these people, of this village?
Well, this is interesting. Back in the 90s, when Tony and I worked at Milwaukee PBS as freelancers, and I would sit and talk with her. She was the receptionist. Her name is Carlin Gallagher. And we would gab about all sorts of things. And she mentioned that she had these scrapbooks, these photo albums, and she knew that I was really interested in history. So she brought these photo albums in, and they were from the turn of the last century, around like before World War I and through World War I and into the 20s and 30s. And they're all photographs of her family from Jones Island. And they are the photographer was, I believe, a great uncle, and he would write on the photos like this was F2.8 and the type of film he used. And he was a truly great photographer. And he took pictures not only of the homes, but of people. And you see people in their, you know, casual dress sometimes, but also when they were dressed up for going to weddings or to a funeral. So there's just, there was this wealth of photographs.
It's a family album of a village that was one of the most unusual in the United States. And beyond Carlin's, these wonderful photographs of Candids on the island, there was a school there from 1896 to 1919. And we have this wonderful coverage of kids on these improvised seesaws, you know, actually probably ship beams. They were on them, then the teachers were on them. So these intrepid young women who were rowed out to the island every day, including during the ice-choked times of winter. So it's a fascinating study.
Well, and to take a step back, the village that we're talking about, the people that we're talking about are the Kashubes. If you've been to Jones Island, there's a good chance you've been to Kashub Park. It is a very tiny park in the middle of a very industrial area. I remember the first time I went there, I thought, why is this park here? Because nobody lives on Jones Island, as you mentioned. I definitely did not realize the history of the Kashubes. Who were they and how did they leave their mark on Jones Island?
First of all, it's Milwaukee cred if you've been at Kashubes Park. Most people haven't. I mean, finding it's not that easy. The Kashubes are kind of an ethnic subgroup from Poland up on the Baltic seacoast around Gdańsk or Danzig in German. And they speak a dialect that's somewhat different from mainstream Polish, kind of German influenced. And it's a little like Bavarians in Germany. You know, they are German, but they're also Bavarian. So Kashubes are Polish, but they're also Kashubian. And they were fisher folk near the Baltic seacoast and farmers inland. My own grandmother's side were all Kashubian farmers. But they came to Milwaukee back in around 1872 and later, and they found this opportunity where everybody else was working in factories to continue the way of life that they'd known for centuries back in Poland. So it's really, really unusual. For 50 years, that community lasted. So it's an urban village in the truest sense of the word.
And the peninsula looks so much like Jones Island. They came from a peninsula called Hel, H-E-L, this little peninsula on the north end of Poland in the Baltic. And it looks so similar, same shape and everything. So it's remarkable.
And there's a reunion the first Saturday of August every year at Kashubes Park. And Tony and Claudia photographed it. So it's featured in the documentary. The backstory there is that is the site of the last human habitation on Jones Island. After they were evicted for the sewage treatment plant in the port of Milwaukee back in the 20s, there was a little cluster of six houses that hung on until they were evicted for reasons of port security back during World War II. So that was the last place people lived, and I called it an act of whimsy, you know, that the city made it a park and called it Kashubes. Very appropriate.
Now, the documentary itself, it gets into a lot more, including a really fascinating layout of Jones Island during its time as a fishing village. I'm guessing, Tony, that you were responsible for that.
Yeah, I did a little rebuild in 3D since there's really nothing else there. From photograph references that we had, I built sort of a section to show sort of the chaotic nature of roads going every which way, because there really was no urban planning there. People just put up a house with whatever materials they found. And so there is a section where John is explaining that if we were one to walk through that area, you'd have a hard time making your way around. So I was able to rebuild a lot of the buildings, structures, things around it in 3D, and give the audience sort of a walkthrough briefly of what that might have looked like.
I won't get too much into the more modern history of Jones Island, but as we get into kind of the more modern decades, we see this a decided change in the landscape. It, of course, goes from being a fishing village to now really just industrial uses. But as you look at all the sum of its parts, what do you view as the story of the island?
change, change, and change. You know, there are a few landscapes in Milwaukee or anywhere, you know, that have been through so many transformations. You go from an Indian village to a trading post, to a shipyard, to a fishing village, to urban infrastructure. You know, that just, it shows you how easy it is for us to transform the landscape and how easy it is to forget what was there before.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian. Claudia Luz is the director, co-producer, and editor of The People of the Port, a Jones Island documentary. Tony Wood is the technical director. They all spoke with me in 2022. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, the superintendent of the largest county correctional facility in the state, now known as the Community Reintegration Center. We'll talk about the center's efforts to set people up for success after incarceration. We'll learn more tomorrow at noon, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.